Hello and welcome to another episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie, brought to you by Killer Podcasts, an Evergreen Podcasts network. I'm the titular Sean.
And I'm the very titular Carrie.
It's the show that takes you inside the unbelievable, the unexplainable, the macabre, and the bizarre, and tries to find an answer. Hello, Caroline.
Hi.
This week, I have a great story from all over the country, from the mid-80s, a time when cocaine was king and it was clear in everybody's behavior.
Okay.
I'm going to call this episode Gun for Hire, The Bumbling Assassinations of Doc Savage.
Doc Savage? This isn't the Wild West?
No, we are going to talk this week about the... Doc Savage is like a pulp hero, but the one we're not talking about today is not him and is not any kind of hero. Richard Doc Savage was a Vietnam veteran and kind of erstwhile law enforcement professional slash strip club owner who ran a murder for hire ring. I was going to say a successful murder for hire ring. They managed to kill a few people, but we'll debate how successful this plot was on behalf of Richard Savage, with killers and victims all over the country in 1985 to 87.
Was it based in his strip club? Like, was that ground zero for his assassin program?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, it absolutely was. And I think one of the interesting things about this story... I mean, first of all, it's fascinating. Murder for Hire. We did Lake City Quiet Pills.
Which could be that or could be absolutely nothing.
Yes, exactly. But the kind of tantalizing possibility there was that like these ex-military guys were taking out contracts to kill people, fly all over the country and murder people for money. And it was like, oh my God, this sounds like a movie.
And they're scheduling it in the comments and the HTML sections of shoddy porn hosting sites.
Yeah, and this is exactly like that, except replace the shoddy like slowly loading internet porn with shoddy like real life pornography, if you will, in this seedy strip club that Doc Savage owned.
Ah, yes.
As I said, they did successfully take the lives of a few victims, unfortunately, and it was while police were investigating this series of murders and attempted murders across the country that the threads started to begin to pull together between all these different cases. So I think it's really interesting from a police investigation standpoint, too. But at first, there was no clear motive for the murder of Anita Spearman, a 48-year-old assistant city manager for West Palm Beach, Florida, who was found bludgeoned to death in her bed on November 16th, 1985. She had been a former reporter at the Palm Beach Post and then was the city editor, actually like one of the first female newspaper editors in Palm Beach for the Palm Beach Evening Herald. And she then kind of turned her knowledge of local officials. She sort of knew everybody in town and she parlayed that into a successful career at City Hall, where she was apparently very well liked. But in 1985, she was dealing with a lot because in the previous year, Anita had been diagnosed with breast cancer. Now, breast cancer in 1985 had a 67% chance of survival. It's a scary diagnosis still, obviously, but it was a scarier diagnosis then. And Anita had opted for a double mastectomy the year before and had just had reconstructive surgery in October to kind of get her body back to where she was comfortable with it. Now, oddly, her husband, Robert, had celebrated this reconstructive surgery with a flower arrangement he gave to her as a gift. It was in the shape of breasts.
Okay.
Little tone deaf for Robert.
Well, you know, maybe they just had a sense of humor about things, you know.
I don't think Robert Spearman had that much of a sense of humor. He was described as a stern, seldom spoken Korean War vet.
Listen, Sean, I'm conditioned to believe that he's going to be the culprit here, and he's going to be the reason that Anita is dead. So, of course, you know, I'm very suspicious, but, you know, maybe they had a sense of humor.
You know, police thought, and always do, a similar thing to you. They started looking into the husband right away. Robert Spearman had been Anita's boss at the Post when they met. He had gone into newspaper typography after the Korean War. And then later on, he went into marine construction. He owned like a dockyard and he did quite well for himself, very wealthy. But back to Anita's death. She was bludgeoned to death in her sleep, remember, and police found that the killer appeared to have taken her jewelry and a shotgun in the room that belonged to Robert Spearman. So that looks like a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously suspicion falls immediately on the husband as well. Now, a few days after Anita's death, a man named Sean Trevor Dutra, whose name will come up later, was pulled over and arrested in Maryville, Tennessee, I think just for a traffic violation. This happens a lot to Sean Dutra. He's not a great driver.
Well, it happens a lot to, I mean, I'm assuming here, bad actors, you know? Like, a lot of these killers and things like that, they get caught because their taillight's out or they're speeding, you know? So, I mean, I don't want to give any official ain't it scary advice, but if you're committing crimes, drive really carefully.
Yeah, certainly after you commit murder for hire, is the time to stop at all the stoplights and stop signs.
Listen, I'm not being specific here, but I think, you know, crime or not, we should drive pretty carefully.
Okay, that's the official word from Carrie, everybody. So this Dutra fella was pulled over and had a shotgun, a machine pistol with a silencer on it, illegal, of course, and $6,000 in cash on him, so police took him in. And he posted bond pretty quickly. It was $10,000 bond. He posted and was released before police called investigators in Florida and connected the dots after tracing that shotgun to Robert Spearman.
Well, why would they release him before it was traced?
He posted bond and they couldn't hold him for more than 24 hours.
All right.
In time, it would come out that Robert Spearman, Anita's husband, had hired a ring of assassins to kill his wife. And he had found this group through an ad placed in Soldier of Fortune magazine.
All right, so we've got a Fargo going, a bit of a Fargo.
We do. The ad read as follows. Gun for hire. 37-year-old professional mercenary desires jobs. Vietnam veteran. Discreet and very private. Bodyguard, courier, and other special skills. All jobs considered.
Well, it's obvious what he's saying here. He's saying he'll kill people for hire. So how is this legal at all?
Well,
how is this allowed to be published?
You're raising a question that many people raised to Soldier of Fortune magazine and its publishers in the wake of this case. So we'll get into that later. But yeah, apparently this was a really common thing, this kind of classified ad, like around this same time. I read that around the same time in Soldier of Fortune, there was a classified ad offering $10,000 in gold for the live capture of Idi Amin.
Oh. Did anyone try it?
I'm sure they did. I don't know about the gold being paid out.
Right. I would watch a movie about a bumbling assassin who's desperate for $10,000, and that's the exact amount of money. So he just has to jet on over to Africa and kill Idi Amin.
Yeah, what's Forrest Whitaker doing? He could reprise the role.
Yeah, but who would be the bumbling assassin?
I'm thinking, hear me out, Pauly Shore. Like, whoa!
I think that's a little too bumbling.
Total shootage, dude! That's after he gets shot.
Oh, I see.
Robert Spearman called the number that was associated with that ad around the same time as Anita's surgery. I think the double mastectomy.
Oh, my God.
And offered to pay $20,000 for his wife's death.
Did he give a reason?
Well, when the assassins were questioned about this later on, they said that he pitched it initially as a mercy killing. My wife is in such pain. I just can't stand to see her this way.
Okay.
But in later conversations with them, he apparently admitted that her disease was, quote, just getting on my nerves.
Wow.
So I'll let that sink in for a moment.
Wow. As someone who unfortunately has that kind of cancer in their family, that is horrifying and cold and terrible.
And puts the breast flower arrangement in a whole new light.
He does not have a sense of humor. I concede.
So let's talk about Richard Doc Savage.
Mm.
As I said, Doc served in Vietnam. He really was...
Now, I'm sorry, was he the one who placed the ad?
He was.
Okay, so it's not necessarily Sean, this other guy, Dutra, or like any of his associates. He's the one placing the ads and scheduling everything.
He placed this ad.
Okay.
As I said, ads like this were not uncommon in Soldier of Fortune at the time, and a few of the he actually hooked up with a few of these guys through they had also put ads in the paper and then called, they sort of called each other and went like, you guys want to link up? Sort of a LinkedIn for murder.
Mm-hmm.
So after he left the military, Richard Savage got a degree in police administration. And he took that degree and spent 3 years as a prison guard in Lexington, Kentucky. And then he went to Lindsay, Oklahoma to be a cop, but he only lasted about 6 weeks.
How was his time in Vietnam?
We don't know a lot about his time in Vietnam, actually.
It's probably bad, right?
Well, everyone's time in Vietnam was pretty bad.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
You know, it's the old story of some people just can't leave the war abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And have a really hard time making ends meet, making a living, finding a new career path, you know, after.
We just talked about this a couple weeks ago.
We did. And, Richard Savage's attempts to
kind of jump into civilian life.
Yeah, I would say they got decreasingly normal, increasingly less normal as time went on.
So why did he only last 6 weeks as a cop?
I don't know.
Okay.
I just know that he was a cop for 6 weeks. Okay. One of his other partners will tell you why he left police work, but yeah, he just couldn't hack it. 6 weeks as a cop in Lindsay, Oklahoma, and that was the last time he would ever work in law enforcement. Apparently, Savage then took a job as an insurance adjuster for a time. That didn't last. He tried to get a restaurant off the ground. That didn't go.
Hmm.
Came around to 1982, and wouldn't you know it, the World's Fair was being held in Knoxville, Tennessee.
These assholes love the World's Fair.
Oh, it's classic H.H. Holmes behavior. Old Doc Savage thought, here's where I'm going to cash in. And he opened a motel in nearby Gatlinburg, where he thought he'd be able to make money hand over fist. Unfortunately, the 1982 World's Fair was in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And it was a huge failure. And so was the motel.
Do they still have the World's Fair?
No, this 1982, I think, came after, if I'm not mistaken, kind of a long gap, and they were just trying to try it again.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that there was one in the 60s in New York, because my dad went to that. But yeah, I haven't really heard any others.
I think Twitter is the World's Fair now. Isn't that comforting?
Well, it's certainly a circus.
So after that motel failed, Doc, I guess, converted it into a nursing home, which also failed. Conditions in that nursing home must have just been great.
Yeah.
You would imagine.
Yeah, so great.
And so after the series of jobs that didn't stick and then the series of failed businesses, Richard Savage was deeply in debt when he took over a strip joint called the Continental Club.
Ooh, very continental.
I believe this was in 1983, but in any case, he was still the owner in 1985.
Could you get a continental breakfast there? Some dry cereals?
Buffet. Continental breakfast buffet.
Eat a donut out of a stripper's G-string or something?
That may have been exactly what Richard Savage was doing on the day in June 1985 when he wrote up the little ad that he ended up placing in Soldier of Fortune. Now, this placement cost him $87.
Not cheap.
And the text again, gun for hire. 37-year-old professional mercenary, desires jobs, Vietnam veteran, discreet and very private, bodyguard, courier, and other special skills, all jobs considered.
And the classifieds editor of Soldier of Fortune magazine did a giant rail of cocaine and went, oh, this looks fine. This is on the up and up.
That's another one. That's what they said mostly in the editorial department at Soldier of Fortune at the time. That's another one.
It's all good.
And the offers started rolling in more or less immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the calls and letters that Savage got were from guys looking for someone to kill their wives.
Yep, that'll happen.
But he also got some interest from guys who were looking to make money killing other people's wives. And so Savage started putting a team together.
I don't got anybody to kill, but I could kill if you want.
I like the idea of killing, but I'm not seeing a lot of growth in the marketplace. Now, in July of 1985, just a month after Savage's ad, A similar ad in Soldier of Fortune was placed by a Michael Wayne Jackson, of East Texas. In his ad, Jackson described himself as a NOM sniper, which was patently not true. But while he was in the Navy, because he was a veteran, and he did see some action over Guam. So the NOM sniper was just kind of a catchy way to market himself.
Guam sniper.
And these are great resume tips for the all the kids out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to make anything up, but you want to make yourself sound as impressive as you can.
So I'm thinking of the film version of this. We got the Idi Amin story going. This is kind of like Ocean's 11 for dickheads.
It's kind of like The Wolf of Wall Street, but about hillbilly murderers.
Yeah. Okay. I'm getting into it.
Now, Michael Jackson, had a degree in criminology and was once police chief of Tatum, Texas for 3 weeks.
Okay.
Apparently, the job didn't last because Jackson continually was dragging cuffed suspects through city council chambers during their meetings.
Okay.
It's like, how many suspects is he putting away?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he's putting away the suspects.
But
so.
How much are they meeting?
Yeah.
Once a week?
Well, they did it at least three times if they're meeting once a week. So he should have probably figured out by the third time that he shouldn't be doing that.
Mike was described as a gun nut. Apparently, his favorite thing to do, apart from thumbing through the latest Soldier of Fortune, was just standing out in his yard in front of the barn, trying to see how fast he could quick draw his revolver and shoot the barn door.
Mm. He also loved admitting that the kid is not my son.
Jackson was once arrested for shooting a dog in his front yard. Well, the two little boys who owned the dog looked on in horror and confusion. So obviously Richard Savage liked the cut of this guy's jib and put him right on the payroll.
Yeah. Great.
Over time, the gang would attract more members. Savage's girlfriend, Deborah Mattingly, got involved pretty early on. There was also the aforementioned Sean Trevor Dutra, a Florida fisherman who came to Knoxville for the thrill of murder for hire. A Toronto teenager named Dean DeLuca, and a former Knoxville security guard, a local boy named William Buckley, not the one from the National Review. and between all of them, they still didn't have enough hands, eyes, and ears to answer all the phones. There was just too much business to handle, and the group seems to have turned a lot of jobs away because there were so many requests.
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of places to find guns for hire because it's not legal. So I guess it is a very specialized business.
Absolutely. With super inelastic demand, you'd imagine. You're never going to change the number of people.
Men are always trying to kill their wives. Sean.
One woman called, a Mary Alice Wolf, called wanting a woman named Victoria Brashear killed in Lexington, Kentucky. Sean Trevor Dutra.
She stole my lasagna recipe.
Maybe. Sean Dutra was sent to take care of it, and when he got there, he saw the potential victim and went, "Yeah, she's too pretty." He just didn't do it.
Okay. All right.
Other jobs they would pursue doggedly for months, partly because of their own incompetence. In coverage of this story, and by the way, I do want to thank both the Palm Beach Post, who had great coverage of this year, that kind of put it on my radar, but also the LA Times, whose coverage at the time, there's a great article you can still find from back in 87, that really covers this case in a lot of depth. And then it lessened the amount of court records I had to look up to do this story.
Sure.
So it was helpful. A lot of the press coverage of this case refers to these assassins as bumbling. Like, the word bumbling is used a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And on June 3rd, 1985, Deborah Mattingly took a call from a man named Richard Foster of Rochester, Minnesota. Richard...
Not Minnesota. That's Fargo.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, hey.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to kill my wife.
Hey, this is just Rich Foster there, having a little trouble with my business partner. And he was having trouble with his business associate, Harold Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
You see, Foster had bought the pub bar in Rochester from Hayes back in June of 1984, the previous year. And as part of their agreement, Hayes agreed to work there for 6 months to train Foster and help out and show him how to run the place. But toward the end of that tenure, he started making plans to buy the 63 Club Bar in April of 1985. And Foster was pissed about this.
Why?
Well, though there was nothing in the contract about it, he felt that the two of them had kind of a wink-nod, handshake agreement not to compete in town. And so he was affronted that this guy Hayes would be opening another bar.
Never depend on a wink and a nod.
No, get it in writing.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't. And so, Savage, Mattingly, William Buckley, and a woman named Linda Smith, who I'm going to guess that was Buckley's girlfriend or something, because she's not mentioned anywhere else, these four headed to Rochester. The plan being for Savage and Buckley to stage a mugging of Harold Hayes outside of his bar, where they would take all his money and break his legs.
So not kill him.
Not kill him, just teach him a lesson.
Okay.
And Foster was going to pay them, apparently, in 6 hand grenades and an electronic bug detector. So we're working on the barter system.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
Bug-like listening device, not like mosquitoes.
This is there. A non-taxable endeavor, so.
Yeah, very true. But that's all the more reason to be paid in cash.
I don't know.
Again.
I mean, I'm never going to barter in hand grenades, but, you know, I'm not going to yuck their yum.
Again, I guess we're in a niche market, so you're going to take what you can get. So, when it came time to do the mugging, and remember, this is June 3rd, Savage and Buckley had a stun gun and brass knuckles that they brought with them to Rochester. And then as a game time decision on the day, they were like, it doesn't feel like enough. And they went to the sporting goods store and bought an axe handle.
Just the handle.
I assume you have to buy the axe and then take the head off, but they just had the handle.
Hmm.
And they wrapped it up in tape.
Mm-hmm.
And they were lying in wait in a wooded area near the 63 Club for Harold Hayes to come on out and, you know, get his knees broken.
With a stick.
Well, and brass knuckles.
Yes.
But there were too many people around. Customers, bouncers, visitors. And so they had just ended up going home. They waited for the rest of the night. It felt like the moment wasn't right. And they just literally went home to Knoxville.
Oh, all the way home. Yeah. Okay.
Buckley would later testify he saw Savage with the hand grenades. So I think this was a payment in advance kind of thing. Mm. And then they just left.
Okay.
But they owed Richard Foster. Remember, they got the hand grenades. So in early July, Buckley and Savage returned to the pub bar to get another mission from Foster. So now this is like a Grand Theft Auto situation at this point, where they like walk into a dusty room and there's an icon over his head. And,
or another settlement needs your help.
Yes, it's Preston Garvey. And so what settlement needed, this by the way really sounds like a, maybe not Grand Theft Auto, but a Red Dead Redemption or Fallout kind of side mission. This time, Foster wanted them to go to Fertile, Iowa to blow up a poultry shed.
That's not just a description that you're saying, it's the town's name.
The Fertile Hills of Iowa. No, it's a town called Fertile, Iowa, and they were supposed to blow up a poultry shed to teach a lesson to another business associate.
Mm.
The shed in question was owned by William Keogh Jr.
Keogh!
And that makes it sound like it's a chicken shack, you know? But Keogh was actually in the exotic bird feather business. So this would be a shed that had a storage shed full of exotic ostrich feathers and things.
Mm-hmm.
Keogh was in other business as well because he happened to owe Foster $3,000 for recent prior cocaine deals.
Mm.
And so Foster paid $1,500 for them to bomb the shed. And the boys went out to Iowa and used a couple of smoke bombs to start a fire in this guy's chicken shed. And wouldn't you know it? On a 40-minute timer, the bombs worked perfectly, and the crew had pulled off their first successful job.
Well, if I know anything from explosions via Looney Tunes, there were probably plenty of feathers left over afterward.
That's true. They float down slowly from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still time to pay up on the main job, the original job. And so the following evening, the boys returned to complete the mugging on Hayes at the 63 Club. So they're there. They park in a back in their same little wooded area outside of the bar.
This club's about to become the 62 Club.
They've got their stun gun. They've got their brass knuckles. They've got an axe handle. And then Hayes came out of the bar. They waited this time for all the customers to leave. Probably good strategy.
Good plan, yeah.
But then Hayes came out of the bar with a pistol. And he had another guy with him who was just holding a shotgun casually. And so they looked down at their axe handle and their brass knuckles and said, okay, we better go back to town. We'll come back tomorrow. We're not going all the way home. And then on their drive back to town, they were stopped by police and questioned and released. But that kind of spooked the boys, and they ended up going home to Knoxville again.
All right.
So second attempt. Remember, this isn't even a murder. They're just supposed to
break his legs.
Scare this guy, and they have not been able to do it. Mm-hmm. It actually is an early quest.
They're getting scared.
Yeah. This is a quest you get in Skyrim early on, actually.
Sure. Sure.
Now, they were doing other... That was early July. They were doing other jobs, including successfully murdering people, unfortunately, in the in-between. And we'll come back to what they were doing in that time later. But I just want to finish the Hayes job here. On August 10th...
Someone has to.
See, yeah, well, these guys aren't. Well, but they did. Well, did they? On August 10th, it was time to get this job done. And Savage returned to Rochester with Buckley and with Michael Jackson.
Hee-hee. Hoo-hoo.
The men built a bomb in their motel room. They had looked up how online. There wasn't any online.
Yeah, we're...
Anarchist's cookbook? I don't know. You can find out how to make a bomb, Kara.
Okay. Freak.
And then Foster came by with a couple of Uzis and magazines. I don't know if this was additional payment or, you know, fortifications for the job or what. This was kind of more of a stealth mission, so I don't know what the Uzis... They didn't come into play, so I don't know what they were for. And Savage told Foster that Jackson was there to be Foster's bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
So the boys went out, they planted the bomb after the 63 Club was closed and all the customers went home and all the people with guns left the building. And then after the bomb was planted, Savage, Doc Savage, and William Buckley got out of town and headed to Louisville. And meanwhile, Jackson stayed in Rochester with Foster. This was allegedly to protect him against violent repercussions for the bombing.
Okay.
Like this guy Hayes was going to come after him, you know, with Uzis, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the bomb never went off.
Mm.
They watched the place. They kept coming back. No fire had started. And so early in the morning, Jackson just snuck back in and got the bomb.
Okay.
He and Foster would rebuild it in their motel room the following day and replant the bomb the following night. And this time, there was a partial explosion that broke the glass door of the club.
Ooh.
And nothing else.
Okay.
So it was time to build another bomb, which they did the following day. This was now August 12th. And in the third attempt, Jackson placed this new bomb in a garage under the club, thinking we'll get some cars and gasoline going, and that's really going to do some damage. But then this bomb still didn't go off.
Jesus.
And Jackson just went home to Tennessee.
Yeah.
The police found that third bomb in the club later that afternoon, and it's one of many threads that would begin being tugged on this murder-for-hire gang.
So it just got left there. How did they know that there was a bomb in the garage? Was it just out?
Yeah.
Next person saw it?
Yeah, they just found...
God.
When he came in to open the bar, he just found an unexploded bomb in his bar.
Wow.
And it was the, again, third attempt.
Mm-hmm.
So how are the boys doing so far?
Not great.
Not great. How did they successfully kill anyone?
I don't know.
And you see why bumbling comes into play a lot here. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we are going to get into the rest of the criminal hijinks and mischief and mayhem of Richard Savage and his team of murderous thugs.
Can't wait.
My name is Bill Huffman. And I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic. And now each week, I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcasts, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.
Welcome back. We are talking about Murder for Hire, specifically the Murder for Hire plot run by a man improbably called Doc Savage. Mm-hmm. In 1985 and 86. Caroline, what did you think of the first half of this story? Are you surprised that these guys got away with anything?
I am, because they're a bunch of stew nods, obviously. So we started kind of at the end there with Anita's death.
Yeah, Anita's death is one of the later ones, and we will touch on her murder again.
So who have they managed to kill so far?
Managed to? Nobody.
We haven't really talked about them being successful at it yet.
No, we just talked about them trying to mug Harold Hayes.
Yes, and blowing up a chicken coop.
Successfully.
Okay, they killed some chickens or ostriches
No,
or whatever.
I think it was just feathers. I have to emphasize.
Okay, I think they killed some feathers.
It was a storage shed. At an exotic feather. I don't know that any birds died.
Mm-hmm.
But the group was still, it was their first success.
Riding high.
And the group was still riding high in late July of 1985 when 47-year-old Alice Bredo of Aurora, Colorado contacted the gang. See, it's not just men asking for their wives to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
Alice Bredo wanted them to kill her boyfriend, Dana Free, of Marietta, Georgia.
Mm.
I don't know. It seems like they weren't super close because they...
Well, literally, physically, they were not.
Right. And probably emotionally at this point. Well, she's hiring people to murder him. So apparently Alice had lent Dana a lot of money. Like something in the tens of thousands of dollars range.
Mm-hmm.
For an investment scheme that had gone awry immediately.
Sure.
I'm not sure what exactly it was, but flying pillows, whatever.
Okay.
Flying pillows, Carrie. It's a great idea because then you can rest your head anywhere.
Hmm.
So in an effort to recoup her losses, Alice had taken out a $500,000 insurance policy and hired Doc and his gang for $20,000 to kill her boyfriend.
Okay.
Now, as I said, Dana was living in Marietta, Georgia, so this was a hike for this crew. I mean, Dutra was traveling all over the country to do these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But this is quite a hike from Knoxville, Tennessee. And I think a bunch of them went, because it's Deborah Mattingly who is credited with helping the group find where Dana Free had parked his car.
So this is like Amy Schumer with big teased out hair, I think, in the film version, Deborah Mattingly.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So she's probably yelling a lot. She's a little yelly on the
absolutely.
On the phone, doing calling Dana and pretending to be a traffic officer or
mm-hmm,
something.
Mm-hmm.
So she helped find where he parked his car. However, she did that.
Okay.
And then William Buckley, again, not William F. Buckley of the National Review, I must hasten to point out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ex-security guard William Buckley, who I think was the most reluctant, or at least he was the one who spilled the beans the fastest when all this was over. Michael Jackson, tried to give him a run for his money. But I think Jackson really liked doing all this stuff.
Mm.
He just really would rather everybody else get in more trouble than him. When they found the car, William Buckley attached two hand grenades to the underside on July 31st. So this is truly Wile E. Coyote.
Literal, like, wet bandits shit. Like, let's be the grenade killers.
And then you really have to hope you picked the right car.
Sure. You don't want to catch a nun on her grocery run.
Well, they did.
No.
No, they did pick the right car.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately for Dana Free. And so Dana got into his car the next day, started it up, and drove around all day doing errands with no incidents whatsoever. Just with two unexploded grenades jangling around underneath his car.
One wrong speed bump, and oh my God.
He didn't even know anything was happening, which was not the intended effect. And so Buckley returned overnight on August 1st to readjust the grenades.
Okay.
Like, because you have to make sure pressure is being put on the pin so that when the car pulls out, at least one of the pins goes.
Yeah.
And so that's what he did. And so on August 2nd, Dana came back. He got into his car in the morning, started it up, and heard a loud pop under the hood. And then smoke, you know, tons of smoke started coming from his hood and into the cabin of the car. So Dana hopped out and looked underneath the car and saw one still unexploded grenade hanging underneath there.
And then he got the fuck out of Dodge, I would think.
He did. He went into hiding with his ex-wife who lived in Houston.
Uh-oh.
So forcing old lovers together, probably not Alice's intention.
No, certainly not.
It wasn't over, Carrie.
Okay.
Later, first of all, by the way, his car wasn't even a total. It needed repairs, but they didn't even manage to kill
Dana's. They don't make them like that anymore, Sean.
They didn't manage to kill Dana's car, let alone Dana. Now, later that month, two more hand grenades. This is like a bad penny. Two more hand grenades would go flying through the living room window of Dana's ex-wife's house. But nobody was in the room at the time.
Because they had fled in a lover's retreat, right?
No, they were in the house. They
Jesus.
They just weren't in the room.
Did they explode?
Yes.
Sean, I don't want to encourage bad behavior. But why didn't they just hide behind a bush and shoot these people? Why go through all of the fucking theatrics?
Well, that's like with... sort of like Gabriel Princeps. Isn't that the guy who killed Franz Ferdinand?
Oh, Gavrilo.
Gavrilo Princeps. His first plan was to chuck a hand grenade at the guy, and obviously...
Yeah, but that was the early 1900s. Things have evolved.
Yeah, but similarly, the hand grenade didn't work. Later on, he just saw him at a cafe and went, oh, there's the guy, and shot him.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what works.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately... Because you're exactly right. And unfortunately, I think Sean Dutra was the most effective operator in this crew, because that is exactly how he handled the murder of Richard Braun on August 26th of 1985. Braun was an Atlanta businessman who was doing pretty well because he was pulling his Mercedes out of his driveway with his 16-year-old son Michael in the car when Sean Trevor Dutra walked up, just stood in the driveway, shot Braun with a Mac 11 handgun as the car pulled out a bunch of times. And Braun fell, car door opened, Braun slid out of the car and fell face down into the driveway, while his 16-year-old son, who had been hit in the thigh, rolled out of the car onto the ground on the other side. Apparently, Dutra, Michael would later testify that Dutra walked over to him and pointed the gun, but then just made a shh sign with his finger over his lips, and then bolted on foot.
Hmm.
Michael would watch his father bleed to death.
That's so sad.
In the driveway.
Now, why was this man killed?
One of Braun's business partners had hired the gang to get him out of the way, I think just because, like, we'd like a bigger chunk of the company for ourselves, please.
Well, I'm never getting married, and I'm never owning a business. Oh, no.
Oops.
No, but genuinely, that's very sad, and people are shit, and that's a bummer. I guess I mean it's sad that they actually got this one right in a way for them.
Yeah. Now, Michael and his older brother Ian, you asked before, Carrie, how could this stuff be published? Michael and his older brother Ian asked the same question, and they would later sue Soldier of Fortune magazine. And they won over $12 million in a federal court for the magazine running the ad in the first place. And they had to pay a lot of money. They might have gone bankrupt in this.
Yeah, now it's just called Soldier Magazine. Good, yeah.
Soldier of Twine. Because this wasn't the only lawsuit by ex-victims.
Of course.
And, yeah,
as there should be. They published this.
Another man who would later sue Soldier of Fortune magazine for running that ad in the first place, and he was going to be good at it, was Doug Norwood. The reason Doug was especially ready to sue, because he was a 30-year-old law student in 1985 at the University of Arkansas. And he was enjoying law, but what he was really enjoying was the hot young thing he was seeing, a lady named Kathy Gray, and things were going quite well in this relationship, except that Kathy's estranged husband, Larry Gray, had called Doc Savage in Knoxville, Tennessee.
No, twist. I thought they were going to kill Larry.
Oh, no, they're going to kill Doug.
Aww.
So, August 30th at 8:30 a.m., Doug Norwood was in his apartment, just off campus. He was on the phone, actually, with the financial aid office, apparently, because that is the life of a grad student, when there was a knock at the door. So, still on the phone, he opened the door and kind of gestured for the two guys standing in the hall to come in, and he's going, yeah, so yeah, okay, I've got to call you later, I've got some company. And as he hung up, the two men, who were the teenaged Dean DeLuca and William Buckley.
Okay, so Dean DeLuca is probably like, I'm thinking like an overgrown teenager, like a Jay Baruchel.
I think, oh, I was thinking you get one of those Stranger Things.
Oh, a Stranger Thing.
Get one of the Stranger Things to play him.
And Eddie Munson.
Eddie Munson might look too old even. No, Eddie Munson's perfect.
Or a Finn Wolfinghard.
Yeah, Finn Wolf, although, honestly, he's a little overexposed. We could use a little.
Wow.
I loved him in It, but come on, guys.
Wow. Tough breaks, Finn.
Give me more Dustin, please.
That's Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, I know. Okay. No, we're going to go. Okay. I need to finish this story.
Yes, yes.
I'm so excited about Sweeney Todd. DeLuca and Buckley introduced themselves as private investigators and said they were looking into another law student at the University of Arkansas, and they just wanted to ask him a couple of questions. I think that's Buckley speaking, but almost before he finished the sentence, DeLuca charged at Doug. Charged at Doug while producing an electric stun gun from inside his shirt.
They're always using these gadgets.
Well, it's probably the same stun gun that they didn't use on Harold Hayes the month before.
Right.
Now, Norwood, as this guy's kid is charging at him, defensively kicked out and caught DeLuca in the chest, apparently breaking four of his ribs.
Oof.
So while DeLuca's recovering from that, though, meanwhile, Buckley had apparently grabbed Norwood's rifle, which, you know, secure that thing, Doug. What, it's just lying on the ground?
Like in his dorm?
It's an apartment, but yeah.
Jeez.
So Buckley had grabbed Norwood's own rifle and shot him in the shoulder. He's running, obviously, at this point. Fled down the hall with gunshots ringing out behind him, down a long, long, like, horribly long giant balcony that he had in this apartment, and caught another bullet in the leg as he hit the bottom of the stairs.
Pranged it.
Made it about half a block and collapsed in a parking lot. And Doug looked up to see a couple who were standing by a running car. And he cried out to them for help. You know, call the police. I'm bleeding. There's guys after me. And the couple looked at each other and then back up at the apartments, got in the car and left.
Now, this wasn't like Deborah and like...
Deborah and Richard?
I fucking knew it.
It sure was.
I knew it.
And they were waiting for DeLuca and Buckley as the getaway drivers. But and you might think, like, oh, it's rude of them to drive away. But that was because they could see that DeLuca and Buckley were actively running the wrong direction.
Okay.
So they ran the wrong way for the getaway car.
Okay. Well, at least Doug's still alive.
Doug is still alive. But this investigation didn't go well for him at first. First, because he failed a polygraph test.
Doug.
About the incident.
The victim.
Doug.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Larry Gray, who was the obvious first suspect because he was the angry, you know, kind of ex-husband. I don't think they were divorced yet, but ex-husband, effectively, of Doug's girlfriend. Larry passed a lie detector test, saying that he hadn't hired anyone. And it wouldn't be until later that police found out...
It's bunk science, folks.
It is bunk science. And it wouldn't be until later that police found out that Larry Gray had actively sought advice for beating polygraph tests and had taken several practice tests before the police got to him. But from the police's perspective, here's this bearded law student from Florida, and prosecutors saw that as a big cocaine state.
What does the beard have to do with it?
It's the 80s, so he's got to be, he kind of looks like a drug guy.
He looks like the Hans Bubby guy from Die Hard.
100%. And he's got a mysterious gunshot wound. They think this is a cocaine deal gone wrong. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when Norwood got back home from the hospital and the police station, he found the stun gun that Dean had used on him literally still lying on the floor. And several bullets that had been fired from his rifle were still in the wall because police hadn't bothered prying them out for ballistics.
Oh my God.
So Doug Norwood's getting nowhere with camp. This is campus police. He's getting nowhere with campus police.
The real police didn't want to come in on this one.
Well, in some places, in University of Arkansas is one of them. It's their university police aren't like rent-a-cops. They're like an actual police department.
Yeah, you say so, and then they're not doing any actual investigative work, so...
No, which makes it all the worse that they do have actual jurisdiction.
Ugh.
Meanwhile, the killers still had Doug dead in their sights. Not dead, but in their sights. On October 1st of 1985, a couple months later, things were going even better. Kathy Gray had moved closer, and she and Norwood were getting closer in their relationship. By the way, it's a cute story. They remain married today and run a law practice together in Arkansas.
Okay, well, I like that happily ever and happily ever after spoiler, because I was getting real sad.
I already said Doug sued these guys later, or sued Soldier of Fortune.
That's true, yes.
On the morning of October 1st, Doug was driving Kathy's Ford Escort, and he went and parked in the University Stadium parking lot to go and do his business on campus. When he came back and started the car, wouldn't you know it? There was a loud pop from under the hood and then a lot of smoke.
They're just hanging grenades under people's car like those truck nuts.
This time, they had actually built a bomb this time, but we know how good they are building bombs.
Yeah.
And so the bomb, just like the one at the club before, only partially exploded and did enough damage to damage the car, but again, not total it, I don't think, and not kill anyone inside.
They don't make them like that anymore, Sean.
80s, give me an 80s Ford Escort, I guess. Sure. University police still found Norwood's story a little weird.
I mean, it's weird, but it's not his fault.
When he went back to them this time, he had a whole story about, I think someone's out to kill me, and I think they first tried before I even got back to campus. Because when I was still in Florida, this woman, see, she said she also went to University of Arkansas, she was trying to get back here, and she wanted to travel back together. But then she had to move the location, she asked if I could pick her up in Memphis, and when I got there, there was just some weird muscular kid sitting there.
Big, thick kid. And was it Deborah?
It would later come out that it was Deborah, and I think it was Dean.
Fucking knew it.
So... he's right about all this, but as he's telling the story...
it sounds insane, because it is.
And the campus police felt that he was remembering, like, names and even motel room numbers, like, too specifically, and it just felt like a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, they were getting annoyed because he was calling, like, every day to say that he was being followed.
This poor man.
But finally, the police heeded Norwood's call and found the Ford sedan that he said he had seen following him. And what do you know? The police saw it following him. They saw it, you know, behind him. And they went up and said, okay, let's see what this is about, I guess. And they found that the sedan was driven by a pleasant man who introduced himself as Michael Wayne Jackson. He flashed a badge.
You're not even going to use, like, a fake name for your name that's very memorable.
Well, he was flashing a badge to explain that he was the former police chief of Tatum, Texas. Anyway, I'm just looking into a few of the programs around here, you know, flip the wallet closed and hope that'll get you through. It's like psychic paper on Doctor Who. But as he was doing all this, remember, cops, and by the way, police always work in partners, and there's a reason, because one of them was talking to Michael Jackson, while the other one was taking observation of his surroundings and seeing an assault rifle poking out from under a blanket in the back seat.
Ho ho.
And a pistol with a silencer taped under the steering wheel. Now, those are both illegal.
Yeah.
In Arkansas, even then. So Jackson was arrested by university police. He certainly didn't have permits for him. And he basically immediately started talking about all the bombings and shootings.
He's bad. He's bad.
You know it. But it would take months for them to verify and track down everything that Jackson was telling them and admitting to, and it would take them a while to even believe him that there were other people involved and this wasn't just his assault rifle. But the rest of the gang was still out there. On October...
Tito, LaToya, others.
Oh, not the Jackson 5, sorry. I don't think LaToya was ever in the 5.
She was around.
She's the 7th. On October 30th of 1985, Mary Thielman and her 3 children boarded a flight from Austin to Dallas-Fort Worth. Her husband Albert was not with them, but he had sent them on the trip as a surprise. Hey guys, you're going to Dallas-Fort Worth today!
Yippee.
Yeah, I don't know what this was to celebrate in particular, but Albert might have been celebrating the fact that he just took out a $2 million life insurance policy on his wife and children.
How obvious can you be? And how sick?
When people take these massive life insurance policies...
And then they get so excited that they can't wait for more than a month. It's like, yeah, we know it's you.
Well, Albert Thielman needed the money now. He was a bad, bad boy. And cocaine addiction, gambling addiction, and a series of extramarital affairs had left him deeply in debt that he couldn't tell his wife or, you know, the law about.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's called Savage to, as he saw it, take care of the problem.
Why kill the kids, too?
Well, you're going to cut down a lot of your expenses that way. He's just trying to balance the books.
Sick.
Mary Thielman's flight went more or less without incident. Although after landing in Dallas, there was a small pop from the cargo hold.
You're joking.
As an explosion went off.
They tried to bring down the entire plane?
And a thin wisp of smoke slowly kind of protruded from the bottom of the plane and through the cabin, but there were no injuries on board. Mary was chilled to the bone, though, when she heard that the explosion seemed to have originated in her cosmetics case.
Uh-oh.
It was placed there by Albert, police determined, after being purchased from Richard Savage and Company, hence the terrible bomb. And yeah, Carrie, there were 154 people aboard the plane.
See, that's the thing. It might not be my time to go, but maybe it's Mary's. And I'm just going with her? Absolutely not.
It's brutal. Luckily, the bomb only went off after the plane landed, and actually only did $1,200 in damage to the plane.
Okay.
So so even if it had happened in flight, I think they probably would have just done an emergency landing and been okay.
Wow.
But this guy tried to hire someone to bring down an airliner full of people.
But he didn't really. He hired someone to give him a grenade, basically.
A bomb. They made a little bomb.
Okay, yeah. All right. The worst bomb makers ever, which is good.
100%.
Good for everyone else, not good for them.
That'll return us to Anita Spearman, the last successful, quote-unquote, murder committed by this gang. And again, Anita was killed on November 16th of 1985. Her husband, Robert, had hired...
this piece of shit.
Savage for $20,000. Now, if you remember, Sean Trevor Dutra was arrested not long after committing this murder, but he posted bond and fled before police could figure out who they had.
I'm thinking this is Sebastian Stan, but as Jeff Galooly from I, Tonya.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to say Sebastian the Crab, but Sebastian Stan's good casting, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another gang member, Ronald Emert, had also been involved in the Spearman scheme. He'd handled some of the money. He took some money from Robert Spearman and got it to Savage. He ended up feeling like the heat was being turned up a little too high. If your conspiracy gets too large, this will always happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Emert was arrested, he immediately turned state's evidence. Robert Spearman, Anita's husband, got life plus 20 years in prison.
Good. He sucks.
Well, he had no intention of serving it.
So
Spearman tried to pay 2 undercover police officers $55,000 to steal a helicopter and bust him out of prison. The officers tried to steal the helicopter but were caught.
They actually did it?
And his written instructions to the officers.
Honey, when we said put things in writing, we didn't mean this.
Asked them to have 2 machine guns and 4 hand grenades on board so he could use them to murder his prosecutor.
And I want you to release the members of the Golden Dawn.
Yes!
I read about them in Forbes.
3 days after this escape attempt was thwarted, Spearman was found hanging in his cell by his bedsheets.
Rest in piss.
Absolutely. Hilariously, in his suicide note, he says in part, "Please forgive me for this, but it seems all the good judgment I have had through all the years has left me since Anita's death."
I think it was before that.
Since Anita's death?
I think it was before that.
And is it forgive me for the suicide or for the escape attempt? He's not talking about the murder, it seems clear.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, now all the threads were really coming together, because you had obviously something going on in the Spearman case, you had obviously something going on in the Thielman case, you had obviously something going on in the Norwood case, and you had these other murders and attempted murders, Braun, Dana Free, the threads started to come together. And in February of 1986, investigators into the Spearman murder were ready to move on to Sean Trevor Dutra and Richard Savage. But it turned out they were both already in jail. Sean Trevor Dutra had been arrested that month in Athens, Georgia, where he and Richard had traveled to kill a man for $4,000. So they're cutting their rates.
Wow. Was this Black Friday sale or something?
As is kind of his MO, Dutra was picked up, I believe, on a traffic violation, but had a bunch of guns in his car. And like Michael Jackson, he immediately started talking. And Richard Savage, who happened to be in town for the job, was the one they picked up next. Around this time, the investigations, obviously around Spearman, but also Mary Thielman and Doug Norwood were coming together, and indictments piled up for all the gang members, including Deborah, including William Buckley. Savage gave interviews from jail to local and national media, in which he admitted posting the ad, but he said, "I didn't know that people were going to ask me to murder people."
Okay.
He said he was appalled and horrified at the kind of answers he got. He was shocked.
Yeah, I mean, I did it, but I didn't like it.
No, he said, "I do not kill people. To inflict..."
I hire people who kill people.
"To inflict pain is against everything I've been taught in the Bible."
Okay.
This defense was to no avail.
Yeah.
Sean Dutra would get life plus 30 years in prison. Savage, who I don't think pulled the trigger on any of these victims, got 40 years, and he ultimately died in prison in 2011.
Bryan Cranston, I think.
For Doc Savage?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean...
He thinks he's a mastermind, but he's really not.
See, you... If you watch more Breaking Bad, which...
No, I'm going by just Bryan Cranston's talent.
I know, but I think he's too intimidating to be Doc Savage.
He's the dad from Malcolm in the Middle. No. He knows how to not be intimidating. He's got range. The man's got range.
I just think Heisenberg has too much gravitas, but we'll work on it, Carrie. Okay. We'll work on a pitch.
Okay.
So what do you think? What do you think of the bumbling assassinations of Doc Savage?
Listen, all the failures are very funny, of course. Again, it's Ocean's 11 for dickheads. You know, there are very humorous aspects to it, but it's also very sad and tragic that they managed to get some of these people. You know, they managed to kill some people. And that's probably partially because the police weren't really putting things together like they should have been, even though there was evidence maybe everywhere. You know, so these people...
Very inept operators.
Right.
Sure.
So I think, much like several other cases we've discussed, the ineptitude of the investigation directly led to more people dying than really should have, you know? Because I think it was just a question of time. Like, they had just more time to give it extra shots, and they gave 2-3 shots sometimes to some of these. So it's obviously horrible that they were successful ever.
You're right. Their targeting of Harold Hayes was, what, 3 visits over 3 months? And, of course, they still failed to do anything to Harold.
So, you know, it's sad for the victims, and it's stupid for them. For the Doc Savage gang, as it were. And, you know, Good riddance.
Especially to Robert Spearman.
Oh, yeah. Fuck that guy.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Let's take a trip to the Bizarre Bazaar. This past November, Heritage Auctions announced that they would be auctioning off 476 pieces of the famed Forest Fenn treasure, finally found in 2020 by a man named Jack Stoof, as we previously reported.
This was the riddle scavenger hunt by the eccentric millionaire.
Mm-hmm. And the auction has now concluded, with all of the items selling for a grand total of over $1.3 million. Now, as you mentioned, Sean, for those who need a refresher, Forrest Fenn was an eccentric art dealer who buried a collection of gold coins and artifacts in the Rocky Mountains back in 2010, publicly releasing clues to its discovery in hopes that the most intrepid adventurer would find it. It took a decade, but one did, Jack Stoof. And now it seems Jack is probably around a cool $1 million richer. Hmm. The highest priced item was a huge gold nugget weighing in at over a pound, which sold for $55,200. A sealed glass jar containing what is said to be a 22,000 word autobiography penned by Forrest Fenn himself went for a high price too, at $48,000.
So in the jar is a book or a little notebook or something?
I assume a notebook or papers. 22,000 words isn't too crazy.
Has anyone opened it?
That I don't know. It was still sealed when it was auctioned off this week. The lowest price item at the auction was 3 grams of gold dust, which sold for a relatively reasonable $900.
Sure, for Forrest Fenn gold dust? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Now that Fenn's treasure is spread to all the auction winners, it will be separated for good, though the Heritage Auctions website offered a great look at every piece altogether, including other interesting trinkets like a Tirona necklace from circa 500 to 1000 AD Colombia, frog pendants from circa 700 to 1000 AD Costa Rica or Panama, and many valuable antique gold coins. Most of the treasure was made up of gold nuggets of differing sizes, gold coins, and other gold ephemera.
Wow. If I was going to bury a treasure, it would... Like, I guess it would just have a bunch of dice in it and stuff. Like, I don't know what I could really have that I could...
I think it would be more of a capsule than anything. So, rest in peace, Mr. Fenn, you crazy bastard. And, you know, congrats to everyone that got a little piece of the treasure at the auction.
Absolutely. Although, I guess... But there's something hits me wrong about being the, like, I wouldn't want to be the person who bought a piece of that treasure for $500,000 or something.
No, but I would buy something for like 100. Like this was part of a treasure cache, you know, like a little piece of gold dust or something just to put in my little curio cabinet.
Yeah, that just feels like future shame because every time you show it to someone, you go, look, this was in a treasure cache. You heard of Forrest Fenn and they go, you found that? And you go, no, I bought it.
I still think it's cool. I wouldn't pay $55,000 for anything, though.
Well, nothing's that expensive here at the Bizarre Bazaar. Beautiful.
That's it for this episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ain't It Scary, and check out our website at ain'titscary.com. You can support the show by supporting our sponsors and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/ain'titscary. You can call us and leave a message at our Google Voice number, 203-666-5529. And please subscribe to the show and throw us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'll be forever grateful.
Yes, we will. And special thanks, special gratitude, if you will, to our beloved top-tier patrons, Nate Curtis, Sean O'Donnell, Jared Chamberlain, Maria Ferrante, Robin McCabe, Compy Mike, Alex Nakutis, Ryan Regan, Christy Atchison, Ira, Kate Pope, and Haley. We love you guys.
See you next Thursday.
Show created by Sean and Carrie McCabe, music by Kyle Ryan. You can find Kyle at his YouTube channel, Music is a Verb.
Ain't It Scary has been brought to you by Killer Podcasts and is a production of Longboy Media.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence and give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.